You're listening to an Airwave Media Podcast.
Have you ever wondered who the Mary was from Bloody Mary? If the Loch Ness Monster was real, or if Ouija boards actually worked? On each episode of the family-friendly Unspookable, we look at the histories and mysteries behind your favorite scary stories, myths, and urban legends to get the real stories behind the scares. Want to solve your next mystery? Find and follow Unspookable now, wherever you get your podcasts.
Today's episode is going to be about Tom DesLongchamp, a contemporary artist who works in a variety of media, but his marker drawings have been living rent-free in my brain since I first stumbled across it like a year ago.
I feel like Who Art Ed?
I'm trying to spice it.
Mr. Wood, Art Ed, me.
Yeah. Either way, it's ambiguous. It works on so many levels.
I know.
That's off to a great start.
Welcome to Who Arted, where we explore visual arts in an audio medium. I'm your host, Kyle Wood, and joining me once again, I have my good friend, Emily Fiedler. Thank you so much. I really appreciate it.
Yeah, I'm happy to be here.
So today, I am excited. We're talking about an artist, a contemporary artist, Tom DesLongchamp. And for once, I know I got the pronunciation about right because I actually asked him, how do you say your name? And he was nice enough to spell it out phonetically for me.
That's perfect.
He said there's probably like, you know, some French history there that, but like his family has dumbed it down to DesLongchamp. So, I appreciate that they apparently also need the American phonetic pronunciations.
Yes.
So right off the bat, he was born October 7th, 1984. So like as I was going through this biography, I'm just going to tell you, I was having so many moments of like connection because like I was born at the end of 83. Like he and I went to school at like the same time, studied some of the same stuff. So this was a little bit weird in terms of the way that some of this stuff, like I just found myself relating to so many aspects
of connections.
The yeah. So hopefully I can do him justice because I am loving his artwork and don't want to piss him off. to get started, he doesn't really remember his first drawings. He says his mom said that before he could even talk, he was drawing walking windows, little windows with faces and arms and legs, which I just find absolutely delightful as an image. And I would love to see him making those and animating those as an adult. 'Cause
I thought the exact same thing when I was reading through the bio that you sent. Like, I visualized what it looked in my mind and I was like thinking about like the cartoons of the time and like where he would pull the imagery from.
See, what I was thinking was I was thinking of, you know, that because you and I are both art teachers, that schematic drawing phase of like, you know, the person as the circle face with arms and legs coming out of it. I was picturing a slightly more rectangular version of that, you know.
I was like, picturing like Schoolhouse Rock, like, but like the bill, like the paper, yeah. The bill becomes the law. Like that's, but like simpler.
Yeah. See, I'm imagining as a child, he was doing something very much like just sort of circle square with arms and legs coming out of it. But I imagine today it would be almost like Keith Haring style kind of faces, rectangular. I don't know. We probably should move on though because we're like at what 2 years of life into this.
You're covering so, his whole life.
We are covering it all. He grew up in Seattle. He said his parents had like a big property south of the city, and for those growing up today this may seem a little bit hard to imagine, but like in the 80s, children were feral. I mean, he was able to go and explore, build forts, going into abandoned spaces. He talked about like an abandoned high school that he would explore, you know, doing a lot of the stuff like that as a kid. I wasn't a skateboarder. I was more of the like inline skating, but like, you know, the way we would do all of that sort of stuff, skating, BMX, biking. He liked karate. He was into like the solo stuff. Mm-hmm. And I always find it interesting, like he describes his childhood, a lot of fun of the exploration and that independent autonomy. It's like, it's the dream and the nightmare of like children left to run wild, because he says he was also apparently doing all this stuff, exploring at a space where a serial killer had like dumped several victims.
Yeah. So like,
ugh. But like, maybe that's why we don't get to explore like that anymore.
Probably why my childhood was a little bit more like watched, like supervised.
But I gotta say, there was something like, because as my house growing up was on a wooded area, and I vividly remember just that sense of independence and like the pride in building stuff with the found objects and materials of the woods, you know, whether it's sticks or you'd find bricks and other like discarded stuff. And you'd be like, what can I do with this? How can I build something up until the city comes to, you know, knock it all down? But you, was that not a thing that happened to other people?
I mean, I was thinking about, like, I had a large backyard growing up, and I would also, like, spend a lot of time building and outside and, like, looking at the shapes that the trees made, but, like, no, the city did not. So I was like, oh, a little depressing.
Yeah, like, at least in the woods behind our house, like, the city came to knock it down because they said, like, some neighbors were concerned that people would get up to no good in a little fort that 10-year-olds built. So yeah, but Tom was doing all that sort of stuff, creating his own way in the world. He says like his brother was more into the team sports, baseball. He was doing his own little imaginative stuff, always enjoyed the drawing. I asked him like, what was the earliest artwork that captivated you? And I found it interesting. He said, like, as a 6-year-old, it was just like a card that his family got from like a family friend. Like, their oldest son had drawn something on there. That sounds to me almost like an M.C. Escher type thing, because he describes a pencil drawing a hand holding a pencil in that sort of like, I imagine that twisted, circular, impossible composition that Escher would have done. But to him, it was just like mind blowing that someone he knew could draw something so well. And I found that kind of as a through line in his biography, is he's just having these like aha moments throughout his life as he's like, you know, he discovers symmetry. So when he's at his brother's baseball game, he's using both hands. And, you know, like for him, he says it was like the ultimate artist hack. By just making both sides mirror each other, it would automatically look good and complex and interesting. So, you know, 6-7 years old, just drawing in the dirt while other boys are playing the sports. I'm curious, what's your favorite art hack? Like,
favorite art hack?
I know I'm putting you on the spot, but like my go-to.
Yeah, share yours really quick while my brain goes.
For me, I always tell my students, like, just masking off the perimeter of your paper beforehand, you're going to end up with a little frame around it. And the neatness of that frame is automatically going to send a signal to a viewer that, like, this is someone who is paying attention and like refining their craft. Mm-hmm. And so like, I always tell, because, you know, kids always want to splatter paint and do all that sort of stuff. I always say like, at least mask off around the perimeter first. Because if you do that, then there's that contrast of the neatness and the chaos, and it shows intentionality and all of that.
Mm-hmm.
Do you have a favorite?
I think my favorite hack, which is really just a drawing exercise, is taking simple shapes and drawing lightly to turn them into the complex characters, and like watching like a second or third grader, like just mind blown when they're like, I want to draw SpongeBob. And I'm like, okay, what shape is SpongeBob? And then we walk through that together. But like starting lightly and like building up a drawing is something that they sometimes struggle with. They think they have to get it right away, which they don't.
Yeah, I think that is 100% true. I mean, figuring out how to compose something as a collection of shapes, as opposed to thinking it has to be the perfect contours from the start. Mm-hmm. Yes, that is like one of my go-to strategies as well. That's why I always have students drawing robots, because it's like one of my favorite assignments, because it is so easy to see how it's a collection of shapes to build something complicated. And I'm all about building and discovery and all of that.
When we have like 5 minutes left at the end of class, we started doing mystery drawings, which is just a guided drawing that I lead, and I don't tell them what they're drawing. And so to help them understand, like, we're putting a shape together, but we don't know what it is. And I do them so that they have to flip them upside down to reveal like the piece of what it is. So it was a pumpkin patch, but once we flipped it upside down, that's when it made the pumpkin patch. So even something like drawing upside down sometimes helps a lot. And this is another one of my favorite hacks.
Oh, I love that. I love the drawing upside down, and that just like that, it's almost magical when mm-hmm. something is revealed like that.
That's the magic in art. Yeah.
Yeah. And, you know, to bring this back to our actual topic, that's one of the things that Tom really focuses on, is just like the magic and that awe and wonder of creating in art. Like, that's kind of what he tries to bring to his art. And I would say from my experience, like, he definitely is successful in that. But in all of his years growing up, he says, like, that's kind of what got him. Like, initially he was, you know, like I said, running wild and doing all of the sports and exploration, and wanted to be a stuntman for a little while. But he says around middle school, he had an assignment to do a project on a historical figure, and his mom suggested, I love how he puts this, the crazy artist who cut off his ear. For those who don't know the reference, that would be Vincent van Gogh. And he says he just did a deep dive, like doing all of the research, reading multiple books all about Van Gogh's life and his work. And he was just sort of awestruck and fell in love with not only the art, but just like the passion and the tragedy, and like that realization that art is not just something that's nice to look at. Mm-hmm. And I would fully agree, like the Van Gogh biography and that story, it is all about the passion and the emotional resonance of art, and how he can give life to even the simplest things, like a, you know, a vase of flowers or a field and stuff like that. Mm-hmm. And then he continues his exploration of new media, and I should put new in giant air quotes, because, you know, 1999, he's playing around with like Macromedia Flash, which mm-hmm. I didn't realize is still a thing, but he still uses it. I still have like PTSD from trying to learn to do stuff in Flash, and like all the little wonky stuff, like doing ActionScript.
I know of it, but yeah. I've never used it myself.
Okay. So for those unfamiliar, Flash was this, it's like an animation sort of computer web animation stuff in like the late 90s, early 2000s, when web design was just awful, if I'm being 100% honest. Like our taste in stuff that we thought was like really cool. I know when you see pictures of us from like the early 2000s, like our sartorial choices, our clothing makes it seem like we really had great taste, but we didn't. And so Flash was what people would use to put those animations on website landing pages and have like the music playing and all of that sort of stuff that just today reads as tacky and annoying and over the top. But like to us in the late 90s, it was cutting edge. And I did spend quite a while trying to learn to animate in Flash. I did a little bit of like really bad animation in Flash, and like learning action scripting was the coding language. It was kind of like JavaScript and all of that.
Okay.
But yeah, that was one that like I'm like shrinking a little bit just hitting that part of my notes about like Macromedia Flash and all of that.
He clearly didn't have as much of a traumatic experience as you did, seeing as he's
good at what he does. Mm-hmm. That's the difference. I was just doing
stuff.
You have
different talents.
I'd hope so, but yeah, he was, and that's one of those things that I think, again, it's just the awe of what you could do, because that was something new, a new frontier in the earlier sort of Wild West days of the internet. And that's kind of what he did when he went to college. Then, you know, he went to RISD, which, mm-hmm. You know, a very good school if you like to draw bicycles. And after college, he gets a job, and he said, like, one of the things, and this is what kind of leads into the artwork we're going to be discussing today. While he was at that job, he always carried a sketchbook with him, and he would be like, his boss didn't care if he sketched a little bit from time to time. He's making doodles because he really wants to be creating something every day, whether it's a drawing, a painting, an animation, writing a song. Like, he's just got that drive to create something every single day, which I think is a fantastic habit. Mm-hmm. That's how you become more creative, by just sitting down and doing it. But he felt that need to create. And so while he's at work, he's got his sketchbook, and he started doing daily portraits of his friend Mike. And after he was like refining that process a little bit, he starts thinking about, how can I get some color in there? And so literally he just looked around and he saw a Crayola red marker just sitting out on the floor. And so that's what he used. But as you and I both know, one of the drawbacks to markers is the same thing that a lot of people love about it. It's really bold, saturated colors, mm-hmm. as a general rule. So rather than drawing directly on the paper, he started to put the ink onto his finger and then used his fingertip to smudge and apply the color in that way. And I gotta say, I have been blown away. Like, the first time I saw those pictures, it still sticks with me. I first came across those images like a year ago when I was making an Art Smart episode about markers, and I needed a story for the first segment. And I saw those, and like, it just stuck in my head for like a year, because I was just so blown away that somebody was doing that with markers.
Yeah, changing the media so much that, like, as elementary teachers, we know very well, and we use like one or two ways. Like,
yeah. And I think there's something really delightful about the use of that elementary medium, mm-hmm. the kind of thing that is so sort of connected to youth and that passion of like your first discoveries in how to draw and how to make stuff. And I mean, he's now using slightly more elevated markers, because as a fine artist, you've got to have archival qualities. So he's using like Tombow markers and, you know, slightly elevated pigments and all of that. But still, he's using that marker technique and the markers in a new and different and innovative way.
And when I was reading through his biography, and like the availability of a Crayola marker, like, you can get them nearly any at convenience store, like grocery stores, Target, Walmart, art supply stores too. Like, I couldn't help but pull a parallel for it with Jen Stark and how like her artistic journey began. I don't know if you know this. She was in art school. She was she didn't have money for all the supplies. And she's like, what's the cheapest thing I can buy and the most I can buy? And it was construction paper. And that's how she started making her animations as well as her sculptures, just like layering it on. And, you know, it says a lot about the materials that like we get to use as art educators. Like they aren't the fanciest, but seeing what others are doing with them and how they're elevating them, it's really interesting.
Yeah, Jen Stark, she started that, I think she was studying abroad in Europe and couldn't bring all of her materials with her. Mm-hmm. And so, she, like you said, she was looking around, what can I get that's cheap and abundant, you know? And so that was how she started the construction paper. And yeah, she's also, I think, right around the same age as us. So another resilient child of the 80s who's just making the most with those early sort of like elementary materials and transforming them in ways that most of us would never think to do. And I love that creative exercise of building something so elevated out of the most seemingly restrictive and confined and limited materials.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and so I guess after the break, we're going to get into one specific piece that actually Tom identified as one of his favorites. Now we're back, and I've got Emily Fiedler once again talking about Tom DesLongchamp, and we're looking at one of his portraits from 2018. This is a portrait of his friend Don. He made this using markers, as we've said. I don't know if it's necessarily his primary media, but it's probably a medium he's best known for because he also does a lot of like really cool and interesting live animations and like streaming, and just he's a cross media, cross disciplinary artist, but it's the marker stuff that just really hooked me in. And so I asked him which was his favorite, and he sent me this portrait of Don from 2018. As you're looking at this, what are you seeing? What's jumping out at you?
I just loved the color and like the transparency of it, like how in the areas where all the parts combine and how the colors mix together. Like I'm looking at his glasses where they meet, like right by his hair. That's something that's really engaging and interesting to me. I also love the fingerprint texture of the flannel shirt because it helps it read so much more as the fabric rather than a flat piece of paper. The eyes, they are always such a pivotal point of an art piece, but once again, the colors and the way they overlap, it almost looks like there is the genuine, like, watery sparkle in the eye.
Yeah, I would definitely agree with that. Those, it's the little details, the highlights that give it that bit of life. As I'm looking at this, I'm struck by how on first glance, it feels like such a traditional portrait. I mean, the framing of it, you know, sort of like the shoulders up and, you know, the face is essentially central from left to right, at least, you know, the face is slightly above center of the paper. But like it feels very traditional, very familiar. Mm-hmm. And then as I start to look closer, I realize like, oh, that's not like a pastel drawing. I see these fingerprints that give it that texture that just, it feels foreign to me. Like I've seen different techniques with markers. You know, you can use them to color patterns. It doesn't have to be solid. You can paint over a water-soluble marker to get that ink wash and stuff like that. But this idea of the fingerprints and smudges, it's something different. In some ways, I think probably because of the stenciling that he's doing, it almost in some areas gets a little bit like a cubist sort of fragmentation.
Where do you see that?
As I'm looking at the layers of colors that are like on the cheeks and stuff like that, you know, I see these sort of hard edges that are starting to define planes and separate them. Mm-hmm. And like, if I zoom in enough that like I'm not even seeing the full face, but I'm just seeing the jawline, the cheek, that kind of stuff. Like it starts to, like I see these edges that it starts to, I don't know, it starts to do something a little bit different, a little bit more abstracted. Of course, I mean, I guess if you zoom into anything far enough, it starts to become an abstraction. I mean, George O'Keefe built her career around that concept, but there's something about the coloring, because it's not like natural coloring.
Right.
You know what I mean?
But it still reads as like a person's skin tone, just like extremely saturated.
Yeah. I mean, there are parts where it seems natural. I mean, the blue and the green and the hair. I mean, I don't know if Don's dyeing his hair like that. I guess I'd have to see the man himself, but
that would be interesting to compare.
It doesn't feel entirely natural to me. It feels a little bit like expressionistic. You know,
I hair off, it helps.
It feels to me like those it feels to me like a little bit almost post-impressionistic, a little bit like that early 20th century where they're playing with non-realistic color schemes and heightening it for emotional resonance and stuff like that. I mean, like there's the warmth of the skin tones and the blues and purples and greens in the hair feel like they are creating a little bit of value and contrast. It doesn't feel like it's selected because that's his natural hair color. And similar in the skin tones, like I doubt he had purple on the cheeks so much, but it defines a shadow. And so there's almost like a, I don't know, like a Matisse-like kind of application of color.
Now, here's the question. Do you think you would be as drawn to it if it was a less expressive color palette?
Would I personally?
Mm-hmm.
No.
I agree.
I wouldn't, and I think that's partially because, you know, when Tom listed his influences, I'm just like, yep, same. You know, like except I never really liked surrealism or Dada the way that he does. Like he says he has that love of stuff that breaks the rules, but like he talked about he loved Van Gogh and a little bit of Picasso, but not really his favorite. Mm-hmm. As well as like more contemporary influences like Nickelodeon cartoons and stuff like that. Like there's this broad sampling of stuff. And in a real way, I think this reminds me of Chuck Close, I think.
Mm-hmm.
Because of the fact that, you know, Chuck Close started off with the photorealistic stuff, but as you well know, you know, he started to get more experimental with like emphasizing the grid and pixelating stuff and making it seem altered. And this to me feels like you're taking that traditional skill of portrait drawing and then just like messing with it and seeing what you can do to break all the rules and break that system apart.
Mm-hmm.
And I love that about it.
I can totally see the parallels too with Chuck Close's like textures and patterns too, with the fingerprint technique and the patterns that are made from the stencils.
Yeah. And there's something really nice about, I think, the use of fingerprints, because there's an intimacy to that. There's like a physical mark of the unique artist's hand in the work. I mean, literally, in some ways, it feels like a version of the impasto of the impressionists and post-impressionists, or, you know, the the different methods that artists would use, whether it's like Frankenthaler's pouring, the soaking and staining, or like Jackson Pollock's drips. It's like there's something on a primal, visceral level about that human connection of their individual mark making.
Yeah.
So I guess to wrap this up, where do you feel like this one belongs? Is this a museum piece? Is this one for the Louvre? Is this one for the lab? Is this one for the Lou?
I have been thought about this all morning because I'm like, I'm going to be questioned this, of course. Has anyone ever put a piece of artwork in the Lou?
Oh, yeah.
Okay. The episodes that I've listened to, I have not heard that. And I'm like, here I am, like every episode, like, it's fantastic.
Well, because I try to set a positive tone in general.
Yeah.
You know, I try to, I, you know, there's so much stuff out there in like podcast land that is like, this true crime, we're going to be entertained by the worst thing that ever happened in a whole bunch of people's lives.
Yeah.
And so I try to have a bit more positive tone to it, and you know, whatever. I try to mostly talk about works that I love or my guest loves. But that being said, I don't necessarily think of the Lou in the way that my college roommate described it as the place that art goes to die, so much as just like it has its time and place, but maybe we don't need to dwell on it.
Like, you know? Fast fashion type trend.
Exactly.
Okay. I'm still not picking Lou. I would put this in the Louvre. I love the creativity and material and use and elevation of an elementary material. I also love the expressionist color scheme and use of identity, both in the portraiture and the mark making with the fingerprints, like you said. I think it should be celebrated. I would absolutely love to walk into a museum and see like hundreds of these just on the wall. And I could spend hours examining each little part of where the colors connect.
Yeah, I fully agree. I'm struggling to find a way to disagree with you because I do love this work. Like, I think, you know, the argument could be made for the lab because it's an innovative use of the tools. You know, it's a different way of looking at a marker, and people could learn a lot from just the study of how the image is constructed. But I think what really elevates it for me is there's something that's just, it's satisfying to look at. You know, and I think that's largely because his subject matter, he's primarily focused on portraits. It's so much about human connection. And there's something like hardwired in us that we like, we will sort of create faces and see faces in inanimate objects all of the time. If you see two circles and a line, you on some level, you start to see a face in that. Like, there's something just innate in people that, like, we find comfort in human connections, in seeing people's faces. And these portraits of friends, they feel warm and comforting and soothing. And the fact that he's doing this with his fingerprints and that technique, it adds another layer of human connection to them that I think is just so powerful. Like, I love the innovation. Don't get me wrong. I always love someone who does something that's surprising and still works. But I think there's something about just the warmth of these portraits that we need to see more of out there.
Mm-hmm.
I think that should be in the museum. That's just something that is surprising, that delights, and also has soul behind it.
Yeah.
Yeah. So thank you so much for taking the time once again. I really appreciate it. Yeah.
Are you going to preview your next episode?
Well, next week, if all goes according to plan, I am actually going to wrangle Tom to talk about one of his favorite influences, which is someone who actually surprised me. So tune in next week to find out what artwork Tom Deslongchamp actually enjoys.
This concludes this week's episode of Who Arted, part of the Airwave Media Podcast Network. If you found this tolerable, please leave a rating or review on your favorite podcast app. You can find images of the work being discussed this week and every week on social media at Who Arted Podcast on Twitter, Instagram, and TikTok, and of course on the website whoartedpodcast.com. Podcast done.